All right, today we'd like to have a conversation about 20 years of rethinking Marxism. We want to talk about the past and about the future, about the possibility of Marxism in the world today, the way Marxism has been utilized by social movements in the past, and in a neoliberal globalized economy, what the future of Marxism is. And I'm here with two of the most significant contributors, I think, to rethinking Marxism, especially when it comes to rethinking strategies for the socialist future, Joe Puttigieg and Maliha Safri. And I want to begin, Joe, by asking you to tell us what you've been doing over the last few years bringing Gramsci to an English-speaking audience and how it differs from the way Gramsci has been received in the past.
Well, I've been devoting most of my energies to preparing a complete edition of Gramsci's notebooks with a large critical apparatus to bridge gaps of knowledge and gaps of history between us and him. And the reason for this is that when I started, Gramsci was an important point of reference for not only Marxists, but people, for the most part, progressive thinkers, but people working in diverse camps. And the use of Gramsci struck me as extremely selective, and there was relatively little work based on a thorough knowledge of his text. Equally, I was convinced, and this was not just me, when I proposed this project, I really wanted to do another selection of Gramsci's work, which would cover terrain not covered by the existing, though excellent, anthologies like the Hoare and Smith selections from the Prison Notebooks. And it was, in fact, Edward Said who persuaded me through repeated and insistent argument that there was something extraordinarily valuable in the way Gramsci worked.
Can I ask you a question about your relationship to Said? Because I've noticed you reference him in your published works. Was this a personal relationship, or was this just intellectual inspiration that you drew from his work? Did you know Said?
I actually did know him very well. I mean, these arguments took place in either his office or sometimes on the phone and so on.
And were these in the context of political activity, or were these purely theoretical discussions? Were you already beginning to think about Gramsci as a strategist or as an opponent of the opposition between civil society and the state?
No, those ideas came to me later as I myself got to understand him more thoroughly. The interest came primarily from my being, first and foremost, a literary scholar. I mean, I'm trained to work with texts and interpreting them. And so was Edward, you know, who insisted correctly that the nature of the text itself merited attention. And in fact, when I started working on Gramsci and I finished the first volume, I wrote something that I had not planned to write, which was an introduction devoted almost entirely, or at least for the most part, to what I called Gramsci's method. The way in which Gramsci thinks is of fundamental importance in itself. This is not because of some formalist interest, but just to mention one aspect of it, because, for example, what Rick Wolf talks about, the anti-dogmatic nature of Gramsci's thought, is perhaps most immediately perceivable in the way he wrote, in the way he studied.
Now, this is what strikes me as by far the most interesting aspect of your project. I've read a few of your essays on Gramsci, and I think I've read the introduction you're talking about. And I have seen you, in fact, quite compellingly break open these reified systems, open up Gramsci's text in a new way. What's interesting to me is that you raise some problems that I've dealt with myself. I also come from a literary tradition, and as a sociologist, I find myself often in foreign territory in the sense that I'm consumed with questions of interpretation, and especially with questions of open texts. So, for instance, I think of an American parallel of Gramsci is Charles Saunders' Peirce. I think there is a whole series of very close parallels, including the fact that Peirce, in the 1930s, his work was collected by a number of Harvard philosophers who put it in the form of the so-called collected papers, which just picked and chose from Peirce's 35 years of writing and put passages together without any regard whatsoever for context. And what you get is Peirce as a proto-positivist, Peirce as a prefiguration of American 1930s philosophy, whereas the Peirce I find is the radical critical Peirce that Deleuze talks about, Carl Otto Appel talks about. And I bring all this up because here's the paradox, or at least a difficulty for me, which is that you and I are both engaged in the same project, attempting to break open closed texts. And we do that strategically by talking about the imposition that previous interpretive systems and interpreters have imposed, or the senses that have been imposed on these texts. So the question I have for you is, why isn't what you're doing yet another imposition? Why isn't it yet another form that is externally created by a reader who is quite foreign to and distant from the actual context of textual production?
Yeah, well, I still maintain it's different. First of all, because I am attempting to be as rigorous as possible in presenting to the reader the text, Gramsci's very difficult and labyrinthine text, in the way he produced it. That is to say, I do not order it around themes. I do not in any way cluster notebooks that might, in fact, belong to a certain line of thinking. Now, clearly, in my critical apparatus, I indicate to my reader when Gramsci finished this note, he actually started in a completely different notebook, writing these other notes while also writing other notebooks. Now, to some degree, you might say in that manner, I am prompting a way of reading him. However, the reproduction of the text in my edition does not do that. The reproduction is as chronologically accurate as we can guess, and there are very solid, reliable ways of dating more or less precisely when he wrote and in what sequence he wrote the notes. So to start with, that means that with an edition of this nature, which is identical to the Italian edition, except I also checked the manuscript since there have been some debates over the fidelity of the transcription. When I do this, I am saying to the reader, it is still possible for you to reconstruct the line of thinking separately. This is how they are in the manuscript. Here is the disposition of them. That is not in itself an interpretive act. Of course, there is prompting towards a certain interpretation with what I do in the critical apparatus, although I am very conscious that it is necessary to provide help without imposing a reading on him.
So you want to separate your own critical apparatus for your understanding of Gramsci from the actual work you've done in reconstructing the
correct
text.
And also, I think this is a corrective, because if you look at a lot of Gramsci scholarship, people overcame the difficulty of the manuscript by picking and choosing. Even when Horan Smith did the selections from the prison notebooks, which I consider to be an extraordinarily good selections, the people who used it in a manner that jumped back and forth, selecting those bits and pieces that suited their thesis. And I wrote, in fact, one essay early on called Philology and Politics using Gramsci, in which I demonstrated how, for example, Bobbio does this. And also a very influential essay on Gramsci, perhaps one of the most influential, which is Anderson's The Antinomies of Antonio Gramsci.
You've cited that several times.
It's based on an unacceptable picking and choosing and stitching together of elements from this vast manuscript, stitching them together in a manner that was going to reinforce his predetermined thesis.
Now, what I'd like to do at this point is begin to shift the conversation over this way, and I'd like to do that by asking you what your thoughts about the relationship between the way you think about Gramscian politics and socialist strategy should be for the 21st century.
To say this succinctly, I would start by saying that the term hegemony, which, as Eric Hobsbawm pointed out, is now almost equated with Gramsci. Gramsci means hegemony, hegemony means Gramsci, you know. The concept of hegemony has not always been examined and understood in as thorough a fashion as one would have liked. Hegemony is a concept that Gramsci did not have when he started writing the prison notebooks. He arrives at it and elaborates it very gradually. And there is no notebook entitled Hegemony. There are very few note titles where the word hegemony even appears. But one aspect of hegemony that I believe needs to be more fully appreciated is that the concept of hegemony is a concept that enables an analysis of the prevailing forces. It is not a concept that starts as a strategy. It is a concept that emerges out of an analysis of the situation, an analysis prompted by the question, how is it that in certain moments in history, the progressive forces who set in motion the processes of change do not end up being, in fact, empowered? And he asks this question for the first time in the first notebook of the Action Party. The Action Party was an Italian party which endorsed and, in fact, expressed the ideals of Mazzini, and the idea was to convert Italy from a monarchy into a unified republic. The unification of Italy occurs, Garibaldi and company, and the people who come to power are not the Action Party, but the moderate party, that is, the party of Cavour. And Gramsci says, why? And he says, you know, the moderate party was exercising leadership in society. Later, he would have said, in civil society, before it came to power. Before, in other words, it took over the reins of government. So political class leadership appears to precede the coming to power. So this is a description which then becomes central to Gramsci's distinction between the revolution that occurred in Russia, which yielded the Soviet Union, and the West, where he says things are different. You cannot have in the West, that is say in modern liberal bourgeois societies, the sort of revolution that you had in Russia, where with one fell swoop, you knock off a regime and you install another. Why? Because even if you knock the center of power, that does not change anything, since everything, the power is surrounded by all these battlements and trenches and all kinds of things, which is, in other words, civil society, the institutions that perpetuate certain values, etc., etc. And this is the core of hegemony, to understand how in our societies we generate legitimacy for power and therefore perpetuate it through consent. So first of all, it's a description. Now, the strategy that comes from it is obvious. You cannot have a frontal attack because it gets you nowhere. That is a strategy.
Now, can I ask you a question about that? And I don't know if you can answer this, but do you see a relationship between the development of his theory of hegemony and his involvement in the factory occupations in Turin, and I think they were the Fiat occupations, right? Do you see a relationship between his actual concrete political involvement there and the development of this notion of hegemony?
Yes, there is a complicated relationship, of course, and many years had passed. Mm-hmm. But in the notebooks, Gramsci is examining, among other things, the reasons for defeat. And the factory council movement, which in fact at one point was on the verge or appeared to be on the verge of success when they took over the Fiat factory in Turin, occupied it, but it failed. And part of the analysis that Gramsci produces has to do with the failure precisely or the forces that prevented this movement from generating a larger base of support and why it was defeated. It's at this time, of course, Gramsci, when he was active in the factory council movement, had not yet even started to think in terms of hegemony. But that experience becomes one of the elements that contributes to his elaboration of the concept of hegemony.
So now, the reason I ended with the question of factory occupations, of course, Mlihab, is because I think what you talked about today and some of your recent written work that I've seen suggests to me, and maybe in part because it's similar to the work I'm doing, that you're doing some of the most important work for rethinking Marxism's future and perhaps for the future of radical social transformation. And that is work concerned with and consumed with the education of desire. So I'd like you to begin by talking about what the relationship between desire and social change and subjectivity, how do you conceive the relationship between those three forces?
Let me start by talking just a little bit about the Community Economies Collective, because I think that that's where I first encountered these questions. Community Economies Collective is a project that joins researchers from ASA, the Association for Economic and Social Analysis, both in the U.S. and Australia. J.K. Gibson Graham have been very important in the formation of that collective. And they did a series of interviews with urban planners, city officials in Holyoke, Amherst, Massachusetts, a variety of contexts, as well as community members and researchers. And they tried to create a language of the economy. They tried to document the diverse forms of economy in which people participate. So they found themselves interviewing and finding out that people are involved with all these different kinds of economy in their households, in their communities. And yet when it came to connecting to or believing in the possibility for non-exploitative economic forms, there was this problem that people somehow either didn't believe that it was possible or there just wasn't a desire for that as a specific form. So we started to kind of do all these reading groups and between graduate students and really going into different aspects and different theoretical traditions that examine subjectivity.
So were these just graduate students or were you doing reading groups with actual workers who are engaged in trying to figure out what exploitation is?
The reading groups took place after those conversations had taken place. So they weren't big, massive community conversations. They were more like a bunch of us slogging through these texts and trying to figure out what they meant. So that's kind of where I started to really get into this problematic. And
did that influence your involvement with the journal Rethinking Marxism, or were you already involved
with
the
journal?
No,
very much so. They kind of began at the same time. So the other people in that reading group, Stephen Healy, Yahya Madra, Jaren Oselchuk, all of us were doing this work. And Jack Amariglio and Julie Graham were also participants. Julie was on paper the teacher of this course, although it was more like a seminar where we kind of met together and were teaching each other this stuff.
So wait, let me understand this. You have a group of politically engaged, politically active graduate students.
All of whom were sort of committed to Marxism.
Who are committed to Marxism and who decide to go take a look at texts like Foucault and I assume Althusser and Deleuze and perhaps Freud or Lacan and make those texts relevant to concrete political activity.
Exactly.
How could those texts possibly be relevant to concrete political activity?
Well, they had to do with the formation of subjectivity, how it is that people come to connect to ideologies, how they're formed as social subjects. This is where I think Lacan was helpful for us, the idea of a fantasy as not just being these private, perverse little things, but also really formative of the economy and society.
I tell my students in social theory that the most important proposition in social theory is that desire desires the other's desire.
Yeah, I got that from Lacan. So subjectivity. This is where I think there's a lot of important work being done in the Occupied Factory Movement, and where they're actually using the language of subjectivity.
So I'd like you to talk about what you said today in the panel, if you don't mind, about the factory occupations and the relationship between that and the re-education, the transformation of social desire.
I talked very briefly, just mentioning a few key elements that I think are pertinent to this conversation. There's about 180 factories in Argentina. There's probably around 1,200 occupied factories in Venezuela. There's a lot more than that even, I think, in Brazil, although I'm not sure exactly of the number there. Anyway, if we just take the Argentinian context, 10,000 workers, about 180 to 200 factories. A lot of those factories had to kind of undertake these long occupations, and the majority of them are about 70%. The Argentinian sociologist Fajin has sort of documented how in those cases where there were long and protracted occupations, neighborhoods were really important forces for the success of those occupations, just by endowing or being there with their physical presence and also giving food and water supplies. And you see this interesting phenomenon where the cooperatives are interacting a lot more inside the neighborhoods. And I gave some examples like Grisanopoli, which staged a series of musical concerts called Musica en las Fabricas. And they invited the Scandinavian Orchestra because they said that they and their neighbors don't have access to that kind of cultural product. So they wanted the factory to be a space for that. Or another cooperative, Chilavert, which opened a library and a community space that was open for anybody to use in the community. As a side note, in Harlem, I've just noticed in the last 7 community meetings that I've gone to, all of them have taken place in churches. And it's a great thing that, you know, churches open their doors like that. Just not once I'd like to go to a community meeting and not have to say a prayer once. So it felt like offering the community a meeting space is an important thing for social transformation. In Grisanopoli, the neighbors installed and invested an alarm system right after the occupation was successful. They said that in case the workers couldn't respond to some sort of reappropriation of the factory, the neighbors could get there quicker. So that required this autonomous movement from the neighborhood to protect this social movement. And in a lot of the cases where reappropriation attempts took place, neighborhood resistance was really crucial in kind of preventing that reappropriation. So in all these cases, you see lots of other examples. IMPA started a secondary school. Quite a few different cooperatives have started educational programs. What I think is interesting about all these is a rearticulation of the link between the factory and the community, or the firm and the community, where the community comes to have a stake in the sustenance and maintenance of the cooperative. And the cooperative also has a stake in the neighborhood. So you see lots of cooperatives participating in this political institution, which is sort of interesting, that started happening in 2001, called neighborhood assemblies. Mm-hmm. So it's not state assembly, it's not city assembly, there were neighborhood assemblies. And the cooperatives had participated in those, came to those, held seats. So that felt like the very grassroots movement.
Now, that's tremendously interesting, and I wonder, do they take the next step and do what you were doing at UMass? Go up from that practical experiment in radical democracy to attempting for themselves to theorize?
In the MNER, that's the National Movement for Recovered Factories, the leader in these interviews, he uses the concept of subjectivity and says that the workers and co-op members are learning to talk and think in a new way. And maybe the problem is that this transformation in subjectivity, it doesn't take place with all the co-op members, in which case he sees a problem for the continuation of the movement. So it seems like they really are creating these conversations with social scientists and trying to come up with ways to reproduce this social movement. And one of the arenas that they've identified as important is this role of subjectivity, what he called creating a rupture in subjectivity, but also reproducing that subjectivity again in time.
Now, this is a question actually for both of you. The common critique that you hear on the left of what's gone on in Argentina is that because of the political alienation, there was insufficient attention devoted to turning this communal movement into concrete political strategy at the level of the state apparatus. And I wonder how you would respond to that.
There's a lot of variety in the occupied factory movements. For example, I think there's only one cooperative who's advocating for national socialization of the means of production in their particular cooperative. The other cooperatives are pushing for expropriation. Mm-hmm. But in 2005, there was this regional conference in Caracas. That's where representatives from occupied factories in Argentina, Brazil, and Venezuela all got together. And you see a lot of variation there. So in the Venezuelan context, almost the majority are pushing for socialization, mm-hmm. whereas in the Argentinian context, the majority are not pushing for socialization. So you have in these different movements different relationships to the state and different demands of the state.
And yet, are they able to build common ground even though they have those fundamental
differences? I think so. I think in that conference, almost all the members, despite their differences, saw it as crucial for them to form regional links. So they established trade links with one another. They also established ways of extending technical assistance to fledgling co-ops in different places. And even if they might not have hope to connect to the Argentinian state, mm-hmm. they did have ideas about connecting to the Venezuelan state and connecting regionally to other cooperatives. So there is a sense of reaching out and creating global linkages, maybe not necessarily with their own state, though.
But I'm hearing from you is that you see a real decentered revolution in the full sense of the term happening, in the sense that linkages rather than the old-fashioned coalitions and solidarities that we imagined from 50 or 60 years ago.
In this particular context, yeah, I think so. And again, in the Venezuelan occupied factories might be different, though. There you see a little more of what you just asked about, where the occupied factories are pushing for a stronger link to the state. And that's also perhaps because the state might be a little more conducive to those kinds of links. So they've set up a whole ministry that is supposed to coordinate and support and provide conditions of existence for the occupied factories. And that's become an explicit component of state policies in a way that necessarily is not a part of Argentina. So you could have a potential coalition between the state and the occupied factories because the state is more open to that there than in Argentina.
Well, I'm delighted that Maliha immediately responded to your question by saying there's a lot of variation. And I think it's essential to address these questions first through very detailed consideration of the particularity of each situation. At the same time, I also believe it is necessary, given if we are talking, for example, about a specific situation like the United States, to move beyond where we were in the 80s in the phase of self-critique. We said, oh, we are the inheritors of an unacceptable concept of party and all of that. I'm not advocating a return to party structures that prevailed in the 50s and 60s, but we have to figure the degree to which our own theorizing of the problem of party has resulted in, number one, a disabling, a true romanticization, disabling of political effectiveness. In other words, the notion that through what on a discursive level appears very attractive, we are not going to have a party structure, we're going to have multiple movements, they will see their overlapping interests, they will come together and a new dawn will rise. It didn't happen, and we are seeing the absurdity of this utopian vision today as we see whatever one might call the progressive forces in the United States lacerated by identity difference, not by the overlapping and merging of perceived interests and so on and so forth. So we need to both do a particular thing, but also get over that phase. And at the same time, analyze the manner in which other organizations took place, which were not progressive, and the degree to which their success was, I mean, not that I like to call it success, but I'm thinking, you know, things like the homeschool movement in the United States and its association with certain church movements and all that, how that success was achieved, the movement that in fact was to some degree both disciplined and also to some degree subsumed under the umbrella of party, precisely during a phase when in the United States, in theory, we were opposed to that. And in Europe, too, where, for example, the Communist Party in Italy, at the first moment that somebody said, how dare you call yourself communist after 1989, immediately said, yeah, we shouldn't call ourselves communist. And now it consists of something like four different parties who, in the face of the right, are saying, what should we do to become more coherent?
Well, this has been a very nice conversation. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Maliha. This was a lot of fun.